During this hour of Focus 580, we'll do our monthly program on personal finance. Our guest, David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He has a wide range of background and expertise on money management, and the point of the show is to take your questions. We'll talk a little bit about the state of the economy and various topics associated with that to start with, but then you can join us. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, or if you're listening online on the Internet anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. Again, the call-in numbers around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. David Sinnoh, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jack, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, it's tax season, Jack, and well over 50% of individual taxpayers have not filed their 2003 personal returns to date, I guess including myself. Now, if you haven't filed and if you hold mutual funds which are outside of a qualified plan, and qualified plans, of course, are like IRAs or 401ks, then it's probably wise to hold off from filing just a bit longer, as millions of mutual fund shareholders will be receiving corrected 1099 information between now and probably well into March. Of course, each year a number of taxpayers receive corrected 1099 information. It's a bit troublesome, especially if you hold mutual funds at a brokerage firm. However, this year is unique. It is particularly problematic due to the complexity of the new tax law adopted in May, but retroactive to January of 2003. Now, in its simplest form, this tax law provided for a cut in the tax rate on dividends. That seemed to cheer people. Previously, the old rate was in about the 38% maximum range, and the new rate is really 15%. Well, what in the world is causing the problem? The law seems pretty straightforward. Like most things in life, however, the devil is always in the details, and our new tax law, of course, is no exception. For example, dividends on U.S. common stocks, perhaps take a stock like IBM, Exxon, or ABC for that matter, qualify for the 15% rate. However, dividends on most preferred stock does not qualify for the lower rate. That's because preferred stock generally is treated as debt of a corporation, and hence your dividend is more likely to be treated or akin to a corporate debt. And that means debt means really interest, and interest earnings do not enjoy the benefit of the 15% federal rate. Now, certain foreign stocks that many of us own, which declare dividends, may not qualify either because of the nature of tax treaties between the U.S. or the lack of tax treaties between the U.S. and the country of origin. Some of us own something called REITs, R-E-I-T-S, which are really known as real estate investment trusts. In point of fact, REITs are actually corporations which own and manage all kinds of real estate, such as perhaps apartments, office buildings, maybe shopping centers, or maybe even for that matter, warehouses. Now, because these special corporations are generally exempt from taxation at the corporate level, the dividends they declare and pay to their shareholders don't qualify under the new 15% rule. Also, for those of us who own money market funds in a mutual fund or bond funds, even though we receive dividends on these funds, really these dividends are in the form of interest, for example, on our investment, and thus these so-called dividends of interest don't qualify either for the 15% rule. You're going to find that those so-called dividends are taxed at your highest marginal rate. Now, the rules I've just explained are really just the tip of the iceberg. The most complicated new rule is this. In order for your dividends to be eligible for the 15% tax treatment, you must have held the dividend-paying instrument, the underlying instrument, at least 61 consecutive days in 2003. So, if you're a trader of funds, and I know that some of our folks buy and sell quite religiously, so you're a buyer and a seller, then it may well turn out you don't meet the 61-day rule and are therefore ineligible for the 15% dividend tax treatment. And perhaps most interesting of all, brokerage firms are not required under the new law to provide you with this holding period information. That's sort of, well, up to you to ferret out with the help of your accountant. However, mutual fund companies are required to provide this holding period information. So now it has become enormously popular to custodian your accounts at major brokerage firms, maybe a Schwab, maybe a Merrill Lynch, a Fidelity, a TD Waterhouse, or for that matter, any of the other major brokerage firms. And of course, most of us know that these major firms now allow us to access through them literally thousands of other companies as well as thousands of mutual funds, sort of the mutual fund marketplace. So all of this holding period information has to first be sorted out by the mutual fund company. It next has to be sent to the brokerage firm. And then the brokerage firm, theoretically, is supposed to pass the mutual fund information onto us in the form of a corrected 1099. Now, keep in mind, if your investments are in an IRA, for example, or some type of pension fund, or some type of profit-sharing plan, all of this noise and all of this complication is really irrelevant. That's because all of the dividends, all of the gains, all of the interest received is essentially tax deferred in these types of qualified plans until you start accessing your money at retirement. And of course, when you start accessing your money at retirement, if you're in a qualified plan, with the exception of a Roth IRA, most of those funds are going to be taxed at your highest marginal rate. So, with respect to retirement programs, I want you to remember that you have at least until April 15th to fund your Roth IRA if you are eligible, which I believe is an outstanding retirement vehicle. In fact, you can not only fund your 2003 Roth IRA, you can begin to fund your 2004 Roth IRA, of course, so long as you have earned income. And earned income is typically defined as income that you've earned by the sweat of your brow. You have W-2 income. You have self-employment income. You have consulting income. Interest income, dividend income, rental property income, that doesn't count for purposes of being able to fund an IRA. Finally, a number of analysts have argued that at least one major reason for the substantial rise in stocks in 2003 was, in fact, this dividend tax legislation. And the analysis is really quite simple. It's one of, I would call, relative attraction. For example, if stock A pays an annual dividend of 4%, that would be a bit unusual, but let's take the example. The stock pays a 4% dividend. If you apply the 15% rule, then the investor really hangs on to about 85% of that dividend, or of that 4 cents, about 3.5 cents on the dollar. Similarly, if that same investor is fortunate enough to earn, let's say, a 4% certificate of deposit, or a 4% bond yielding that 4%, that 4% could be subject to an approximate tax rate as high as 35%, because again, interest is taxed at your highest marginal rate. And that would leave the investor in this 4% bond or CD with essentially about a 2.6 cents per dollar return. So all of the things being equal, dividend-paying stocks are intrinsically more valuable because of comparable tax advantage. Well, Jack, there are so many different topics we could discuss this morning. And as always, of course, I'm delighted to try to answer the questions of the many friends and listeners of WILL.
Okay, very good. Our guest, David Sineau, Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois here, taking your questions on money management and personal finance. We do have a couple people waiting patiently. We'll get right to them. The number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go first to a listener in Piatt County on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions, and I'll try to be quick. Number one, I received a sum of money from an inheritance, and because I had not done any research, I put it into a rolling 7-day CD account, and the interest rate is very low. And then I read something about ladder CDs, where you buy a 5-year CD, you know, and then you buy a one-year CD, and then you just keep rolling it over into your five-year CD. Is that a good idea?
Well, let me ask you a preliminary question.
Okay.
What is the intent with this money?
I really don't need it, and it was just for investment.
Okay, so it's for investment, and it's essentially to save for retirement?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what type of risk do you desire with this money?
Pretty minimum risk.
Okay, pretty minimum risk, other than perhaps what I would call purchasing power risk, mm-hmm. and that is that if you invest in CDs, which is certainly an appropriate investment, one of the major things that can happen when you invest in any fixed income instrument, when you get paid back, your purchasing power on that dollar is a little bit less, depending upon the rate of inflation. But you really don't have a lot of default risk, just purchasing power risk. Now, with respect to your specific inquiry regarding ladders, this is typically how a ladder would work, and I'd be a little bit cautious about going out on what I would refer to as the yield or maturity curve of 5 years. Let's take a sum of, shall we say, $20,000, all right? And I'm just going to take that as a small sum. What you might consider doing is you would buy a six-month CD with one-fourth of the money, so $5,000. Then you would buy another six-month CD, which is actually a one-year CD, that would mature in 1 year. So you would take $5,000 having a maturity of 1 year. Then you would buy a third certificate of deposit with a maturity of 18 months and a fourth with a maturity of 24 months. You follow me so far? Now, when that six-month CD matures, you purchase a new 24-month CD. So you always have a CD maturing every 6 months, and you have CDs that have maturities as long as 24 months. Now, if you think about this, your average maturity is only 1 year. Follow that? And if someone was going to put a gun to my head, although I may be clearly wrong about this, I would suspect 24 months from now that interest rates are going to be higher. I could be dead wrong about that, but if somebody put a gun to my head and said, you must choose, I think interest rates are closer to historic lows than historic highs. So if you believe that, and this is what I've been counseling a good number of my clients, that if you are going to invest in fixed income, you want to stay relatively short term. Because as interest rates move up, then you will have the opportunity to access higher interest rate bonds, fixed income, or CDs. So I would suggest perhaps a 2-year ladder or even a 3-year ladder, where you might buy a 1-year CD, a 2-year CD, and a 3-year CD. But I certainly don't think I would be out there with an average maturity right now of greater than 2 years.
Okay.
All right?
Yes.
So that's certainly a very clean, neat approach in terms of laddering an investment. You can do this with treasuries, certificates of deposit. You can do it with other fixed income investments. But interestingly enough, right now, if we look at the certificate of deposit rates and shop those carefully and compare them to similar treasury rates, it's more likely that you would find a higher rate on a certificate of deposit. Okay? However, something to remember with certificate of deposits, that when you are paid interest on certificates of deposit, that interest is subject to both federal income tax and state income tax.
Yes, I've learned that.
All right? If you invest in a true vanilla treasury instrument, okay, you do not pay state income tax. It's subject to federal income tax, but not state income tax.
Okay.
So you have to compare apples and apples. Yes. Now, did you have a second question?
Yes, I did. When you see in the paper, usually on Sunday, they'll have some bank will offer a 3-point-something% CD, and then the small print, you know, if you put $1,000 and have an account at the bank, and it's then the fine print says that it's variable.
Yes.
So I just wonder if people then get the 3% rate and then it changes in 6 months or?
It certainly does. Oh. It's really called a teaser rate.
Yes.
And there's really nothing wrong with it because it's fully disclosed. And basically, it's a rate that is offered by a financial institution for typically a short period of time, somewhere between 1, 3, and 6 months if you are lucky. And it's typically a rate significantly above rates that you ordinarily would see, maybe 1, 1.5, maybe even 2% higher, and then the rate falls back to the standard rate, whatever it might be. So it's an attempt to really buy new business, if you will. And you will also find banks aggressively marketing this type of instrument when they have strong loan demand, because they are interested in procuring new money so they can loan your money out to someone else and essentially arbitrage. In other words, they're loaning it out at a higher rate than they are paying you. And also, you might find in a number of these particular advertisements that if you are a current customer and you currently have a CD or a money market instrument, you may not be eligible to take advantage of this particular type of product. It typically and often is limited to new money and new people.
Okay. And one more question. If I am separated and my husband makes a great deal of money more than I do, is it wise? We filed together now for the years that we've been separated, which is 4, but I'm wondering at the benefits of that, if my low income and his high income, or is there any benefit to filing separately while married?
Well, you're still married.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, what you would have to do, depending upon the disparity, since you are living apart, mm-hmm. is you would need the advice of an accountant who very, very quickly can run the numbers both ways and tell you what is most competitively advantageous.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
A pleasure visiting with you.
Thanks for the call. We have a couple people waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Robinson, Illinois, on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm investing for my daughter's college through 529s and Gift to Minors Act.
Yes.
She's 12 years old, and we have around $55,000 to $60,000.
Good for you. I'm impressed.
About 70% of it is in stock funds.
Yes.
About 20% of it is in an intermediate term bond fund.
Yes.
And about 10% is in a CD.
Okay.
My question is, at what point should we start converting these funds into more conservative investments or even into cash?
Well, I wouldn't go to cash, but I think at 12 years old, what grade is she in?
She's in sixth grade.
Sixth grade. You've just done an amazing job. Do you think maybe you have some extra cash laying around you could help my daughters who are about to graduate college?
No.
No, okay. Well, you know, I ask that question all of the time, and for some reason I get a smile, and I always get a dispositive no. Now, your daughter is probably going to start college in about 6 years.
Correct.
All right. And remember that this money then is going to be utilized for probably at least the next 4 years and perhaps on to even graduate school.
Correct.
Is that sort of the plan?
Yes.
So we're really looking at a time horizon somewhere between 6 and perhaps as much as 12 years with this sum of money. Are you continuing to add to this position?
That is the plan.
All right, that's the plan. My feeling would be that you should be shooting for about a 50-50 asset allocation at this point in time. About a 50-50 asset allocation. So I'm not suggesting necessarily that you move your 70% out of equities. I'm suggesting that new money that you add be added to short fixed income. There will be the opportunity 2, 3, 4 years from now, I believe, where if you have substantial short-term fixed income, you'll be able to move it into higher interest rate bearing fixed income. But because of the time horizon involved here, because your child is not starting college today or tomorrow, I still believe it's prudent to have a 50-50 portfolio. And in fact, I even counsel people in retirement that the biggest mistake they can make in retirement is to move entirely to a fixed income portfolio because you can lose so much purchasing power. Now, your 529 plan, just so I understand it, is not prepaid tuition. This is actually the 529 plan where you have assets and you have made investments with those assets. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And remember then, with those types of dollars, you can apply them not only to tuition fees and books, but housing and other ordinary and necessary college expenses. So I think you're doing a good job, and I think what you want to do over the next couple of years anyway is to look more toward a 50-50 asset allocation by taking your new money and putting it into short-term fixed income. Maybe that's CDs, maybe that's a short-term corporate bond fund. Incidentally, who is the sponsor of your 529 plan?
Bank One.
Okay, Bank One. And under Bank One, do you have a number of good choices with your 529 money?
There are several choices.
Okay. Here. And I take it that since you have 70% of your money in equities, you're probably in certain mutual funds. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And I'm hoping that those mutual funds are diversified between funds that emphasize large holdings, funds that emphasize small holdings, have funds that emphasize value holdings, for example.
There's a growth fund, a value fund, and a small cap fund.
Okay. And if it were my money, I would probably not be one-third, one-third, one-third in my 70%. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. I would tilt more of my money toward small and value and a little bit less of my money toward large, just in terms of an asset allocation.
Okay.
So if that's helpful.
Okay. At what point would you then move the 70%? I know you said down to 50% by adding new money. At what point would you make the 50% then into more bonds or into more even cash?
Well, I would want to have, if in my 529 plan, I would want to have in fixed income or cash 3 years, three out years of college expenses. Because it's very tough to, you can get yourself into a stock market sort of like we just went through where we had three miserable years.
Right.
And as a result, there's nothing worse than watching three miserable years of college education funds dissipate before your very eyes, especially as prudent and as careful as you have been to accumulate this money.
Okay. All right. I believe you've answered my question then.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
All right. We're talking this morning with David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, about personal finance, money management, managing your investments, a variety of issues pertaining to personal money management. And if you, bunch of ways to say that. Anyway, any question you have is welcome. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Also toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener in Charleston next on line number 3. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I bought some EE savings bonds in 1992. With 6% interest, and they come due now in October of 2004, and I want to know what's next. Will they continue earning interest? Is there some other bond that they can be rolled over into, or what happens to what do I do with those bonds when they come due?
Well, it's a pleasant problem, and congratulations on earning a 6% tax-deferred rate. When those bonds come due, and I would have to double-check this because there are some new rules. Typically in the past, what people have been able to do is roll those EE bonds over into H bonds. This is a tax-deferred rollover. In other words, let's say that you have a bond that matures to $1,000, and you put $500 into it originally, and at time of maturity, that EE bond is worth $1,000. Essentially, you have $500 of principal and $500 of interest. Now, if you simply cash that bond in and spend it, then that $500 of interest becomes a taxable event, and that interest is taxed at your highest marginal rate, and it sounds like you want to avoid that. Is that
Yes.
a fair statement? All right. Well, in the past, what people have done is they have taken their bonds and they have converted them into another type of U.S. savings bond called an H bond. In other words, you now have a $1,000 H bond, and H bonds pay interest every 6 months. So you continue to defer that $500 of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're getting interest on your entire $1,000. But if memory serves me correctly, just this week in the Wall Street Journal, I read something that there are some significant changes in that EE and HH bond program. I believe, for example, that the U.S. government is no longer issuing E-bonds. Remember reading that? I can't recall whether or not you are still eligible to roll over to H-bonds, especially since we're talking, what, October 2004?
Yes.
My best guess is you are, but I'm not absolutely certain. Maybe someone who is up on that, one, could call into the program. Two, I'm certain that I could research it. Or three, a bank certainly could answer that question for you if you simply called your local bank and asked for the individual in the bond department, the E and H bond department. They'll be up on those rules.
Okay.
But essentially, I believe, if memory serves me correct, you probably are still eligible to roll those over to H bonds. And then those H bonds, you could buy a 10-year H bond, I believe, and you would earn interest on those for the next, you know, at whatever interest rate. The problem, of course, is that the interest rate might not be very exciting. That's a problem. So that's an issue of whether it really makes sense to roll those over or whether it makes sense to essentially pay the interest. Also, some people have asked me, well, can I take the bond and can I simply donate the bond to charity? Just like I would donate stock to charity and the appreciation that I've earned on the stock, then I don't pay any tax on the appreciation. Unfortunately, with e-bonds, if you simply gave that $1,000 e-bond to the library, to the church, to the University of Illinois, unfortunately, you still would be responsible for the $500 to report that on your tax return. So that doesn't work either.
So
call the bank.
Okay.
Call your bank where you purchased the bonds. I presume you got them through a bank.
Yes, I think.
Okay.
So.
Go back to the bank and say, gee, these are coming up in October of 2004. Is the H bond program still available?
And if it's not available?
Well, if it's not available, then you are going to cash those bonds in.
So that would be the only, rolling it over to the H bond is the only possibility.
Well, that's the possibility that I'm aware of at the current time.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're going to have to eventually pay the piper.
Yes.
Like all of us. But it's a happy problem.
Yes.
All right? It's still a happy problem.
Yes, it is.
All right. Anything else I can answer for you today?
Thanks a lot.
Yes, my pleasure.
Thanks so much for the call. We're a little past our midpoint with David Sinnoh talking about personal finance. We have one caller waiting and several lines open if you'd like to join us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got several questions. I'll try and limit it, though. First question about the corrected 1099. What if you've already filed?
Well, if you've already filed, and that is a big, big problem, and you get a corrected 1099, and that corrected 1099 has an impact on your tax return, guess what? You need to file an amended return.
Okay.
And unfortunately, if you have a professional tax preparer who has prepared that return, most professional tax preparers, if they have to amend a return, there's going to be an additional charge. I don't know how preparers are going to handle that this year. So that's why most professional preparers, CPAs and similar firms, if they know you have this potential problem, are urging you to hold off. Now, theoretically, these corrected 1099s are supposed to be out by the end of February. But what does that mean? Theoretically, they're supposed to be out. So I think it's a good bet that you would want to wait until March. But you've already filed. Is that correct?
Actually, I haven't, but I was thinking about doing it, you know, gathering things up this weekend and taking it to my accountant. But I do have money in a Janus fund.
Okay. Now, if you have money in a Janus fund and Janus is going to report directly to you.
Uh-huh.
All right. So if you have a 1099 from Janus direct because you hold the funds direct at Janus, you don't hold them through a brokerage firm. Is
right.
that correct?
Correct.
Then what I would do is I would simply call Janus or go to their website, obviously, and you can get updated tax information on their website, or simply call and talk to a representative and say, hey, is my 1099 for this fund correct? And they will know.
Uh-huh.
They will know. So you've got an easier problem.
Okay.
All right? That's the way I would handle it.
Okay. Also, I was curious, do you prefer prepaid tuition plans or the 529 plans with money in different mutual funds, like the gentleman that from Robinson that called earlier?
I like both.
Okay.
I like both. I think you can hedge your bets buying the prepaid tuition and, of course, The College Illinois program is now open for enrollment. I like that program because all of the tuition risk and all of the increases in that tuition, and we know there's only one way that that's going to go.
Uh-huh.
It's going to go up dramatically. You shift that tuition risk, that inflationary increase, over to the state. And the real question is whether the state's going to be able to meet its obligations. I mean, yes, they're going to meet their obligations, but obviously what may happen is that we're going to go further into deficit or we're going to have tax increases.
Uh-huh.
So I like that program. I like that program. I don't think there's any default risk. I really don't.
Now, can you...
But remember, that is for tuition only.
Uh-huh.
And for certain fees. Not all fees, certain fees.
Okay.
And if your child does not attend, say you buy it for the state of Illinois and does not attend an institution in the state of Illinois, then what College Illinois does is they say, what is the average tuition and fees per semester at the 8 or 9 institutions that this covers? University of Illinois, Northern, Eastern, Southern, Western, Illinois State, etc. All right?
Uh-huh.
So they figure out the average tuition, and then that is the amount that will be credited to your child to attend an institution somewhere else, whether it's in New York City or whether it's in Fairbanks, Alaska. It doesn't matter. All right? So it's not like you lose it. If your child says, I'm not going to college, and you survive that comment and don't have a heart attack, then that money can be transferred for another child or for another relative, for that matter.
Okay.
Right? But remember, it's only for tuition and fees. The other kind of 529 program where you've got stocks, bonds, securities, and you're self-directing, if you will, that account, those dollars can be used for anything that is truly necessary and ordinary and affiliated with college expenses.
Okay.
So it's a broader program.
Now, can you invest in prepaid tuition plans in other states?
Yes. You could.
Yeah, because I was looking at a website the other night that rated, different prepaid tuition plans,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
Illinois didn't have a very good rating compared to other states.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I do like the Illinois prepaid tuition plan, and it depends on how you analyze it, but what I am not excited about the other 529 Illinois plans.
Uh-huh.
Those plans, I think there are significantly better plans elsewhere than the Illinois 529 plan where you're talking about stocks, bonds, securities, and self-directing.
Okay.
I'm much happier with Iowa, Missouri, Nevada, several others as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
We have another caller on line number 3 in College Park, Maryland, I believe. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I tuned in kind of late, so I might have missed your comment. But
are you calling from College Park, Maryland?
Yes, I am.
How's the weather there today?
It's really nice. It was actually in the 50s yesterday, and I think we're going to have similar weather today.
Oh, good. Well, enjoy.
Thank you. I'm a federal employee, and I have $50 savings bonds deducted from my pay period each pay period every 2 weeks, and they're e-bonds. I have one for my sister and one for myself. Now, my sister's a minor, and so my parents are putting it away for her, and ideally I would have liked to have saved to help her with college, but she's going to be going to college next year, so maybe when she gets out, if she wants to go to grad school or use that money, you know, to buy a house, towards the purchase of a house. But I wanted to know, are those e-bonds tax deferred? Is she going to have to, you know, do like a tax return and kind of, claim that money or, you know?
Well, let me understand. You're actually purchasing the e-bonds for her?
Right.
All right.
And
so you're gifting. So you're essentially gifting money.
Right.
If you will, to her.
Right.
And how often are you purchasing the e-bonds?
Every 2 weeks she gets one.
And so, and what are you placing in? What is the amount of money?
It's a $50 bond.
Okay, so it's a $50 bond.
Right.
So you're essentially placing $25.
No.
Oh, you're buying the $50.
Right.
You're paying $50.
Right.
Every 2 weeks, so that's 26 pay periods times $50.
Right.
Well, first of all, that total, which is very laudable, is essentially about $1,300
mm-hmm.
per year. And the typical gift tax exclusion rules are as follows. You as an individual can gift up to $11,000 annually to as many people as you desire, including yours truly, if you feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no tax to you as the donor, and there is no tax to your relative, to me, or to any friend or anyone else as the donee.
Okay.
So you don't have a tax issue here for, now this is, I've forgotten, is this your sister, daughter?
This is my sister.
Sister.
She's 17.
Okay, your
mm-hmm.
sister.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no tax impact to your sister.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are being purchased, I presume, under her Social Security number.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So it's under her Social Security number. Now, the interest that is going to be earned on those e-bonds ultimately is going to be taxed to her.
Right.
However, there are some other rules that state that if you use e-bonds and the interest from e-bonds for college expenses.
Okay.
And you find your income under a threshold, and I can't frankly remember what that threshold is for a single individual or for a married individual. I think it's somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000 single and maybe $50,000 or $60,000 married. Then it may turn out that even the interest is not going to be subject to tax, so long as those bonds and the proceeds and the interest are used for college expenses.
Okay. And so how long does she have to wait for those e-bonds to mature?
Well, they're typically approximately 10 years. They're approximately 10-year bonds.
Okay.
Okay, if you're buying e-bonds.
Okay.
Because they mature to, are you buying bonds that mature to $100? Is that what you're doing?
I was told that they mature within 6 months. Maybe I got the wrong information from personnel, but they're deducting $50. The bond is a $50 bond. So I don't know if they
mature. So it's a $50 face bond.
Right.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So it always stays at $50 face. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that is true. Then, if you're buying a face bond, then you can certainly redeem them any six-month period.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. All right. That's great. And I'm doing the same for myself. I'm giving myself a $50 bond also. And my goal was to save for a deposit towards a house.
Yeah, which makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes perfect sense. And of course, as a federal employee, mm-hmm. you're also part of a pension program.
Right.
And you also have the ability to place money into 403B programs,
mm-hmm.
which are separate programs typically. And I'm wondering if you're doing that as well.
That's not a thrift savings plan.
Like a thrift plan.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so you're doing that separately, mm-hmm. and that is with your own money, and you're getting a tax deduction from your payroll for that.
Right.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
So you're covering a lot of bases, so you're doing a good job.
Yeah, I'm not taking a lot home with me, but I am trying to bank it for another day.
Okay, so you have enough to eat on and live on? You have enough cash flow?
Just barely.
Okay.
I may have to look for a teaching position on the side.
Okay, now as a federal government employee, can I ask, what do you do?
Sure, I'm a regulatory scientist. I work at FDA.
Oh, very impressive. Very impressive. Well, I hope that you find some scientific breakthrough that benefits all of us, because you sound like a very, very lovely person.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
We have just about 15 minutes left with David Sinnoh taking your questions on personal finance. We have one caller waiting. Time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Urbana, line number two. Good morning.
You said that you preferred Iowa's 529, and I kind of came to that conclusion. But how do you know how much more tax you would incur, versus Illinois, I guess, where you don't pay income tax or something?
That's a great question.
And how do you figure this out?
Well, I think that's a great question. The Illinois legislature is one of the states that decided that they want to create a disincentive for people to go outside of Illinois to invest in 529 plans. And the disincentive that they created was by legislative fiat, by law, that at least at the current time, if you go outside of the state to presumably a better program And then you begin accessing that money. The earnings on that money is subject to Illinois state income tax at whatever rate the individual finds themselves in, or whatever the tax rate is, currently 3%. But let me tell you that that wouldn't slow me down one moment from using a plan outside of the state of Illinois. I find that 3% negligible when one can really analyzes the 529 plan, which has very, very high managerial expenses. You will more than make up the tax impact for your child or for the individual you are benefiting by choosing a different plan. So I don't have any problems with going outside of the state of Illinois. Okay? I wouldn't even give it a second thought.
Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. My son is 7, and we haven't really saved anything yet for college, and I'm paying attention to what some of these are and the advantages, but how do I pick between them? And how do, if he doesn't go to college and he wants to use that money for something else, should I keep it out of one of those tuition things? I like that guaranteed tuition, but I don't know whether he'd be afraid to, you know, tie that money up in a tuition fund.
Okay, you've asked some good questions. I don't know. I think what you need to do is start pounding into the 7-year-old's head that after high school, he's on his way to college. Whether it's community college to begin with or a 4-year university, he should be on his way, because everything I read in this country is that by the time your son is 21 years of age, more than 50% of all U.S. citizens are going to have a college degree. And I think in a very technologically oriented society, it's going to be darn difficult. Very hard to compete without a college degree. So I think that the thinking...
I agree.
So, and you and I are on the same page on that. So I like, as I said before, if you're an Illinois resident, I like what's called College Illinois, which is prepaid tuition, and a portion of it can be used for fees. Now, recognize that tuition is not the most expensive part of going to college. It's all the housing and all the other stuff, if you will, that costs more than the tuition. But tuition, by the time your son is going to start, he's 7 now and 18, tuition is going to rise dramatically. And one of the beauties of the College Illinois program, and you can go to collegeillinois.com on the internet, is that you can pay for this on a monthly basis. And you don't have to purchase 8 semesters of tuition and fees. You could purchase 2 semesters or 4 semesters or 6 semesters. So it's very flexible. And as I mentioned, you're putting that tuition, that future tuition increase each year on the backs of the state of Illinois. You're taking sort of the interest rate or inflationary risk out by locking in a rate today. So that's very, very hard to pass up. At the same time, the advantage of the second type of 529 plan, where you invest money in self-directed investments, for example, stocks, bonds, or other types of securities, all of the gain on those stocks, bonds, and securities, frankly, from age 7 till they're utilized in college, all of that gain escapes federal income taxation. And that's very, very key. So I like both programs. So what I'm urging people to do is, if they can do both, and that is obviously to go and do both. But as a start, I would at least get involved with the College Illinois program.
Okay. I had another idea that if you have all that money sitting there and it says college on it, then the state's going to be like, okay, well, we'll hand it over, and maybe a person should save, like, in their retirement, with the idea that you could borrow money out.
Don't like that. Not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of you hemorrhaging your retirement. Absolutely not.
And some other thing that's mine, okay, so that the state doesn't say, you know, well, look, you got all the money sitting there, just hand it right over.
Well, you know, I'm not worried about that. I think the voters would have such an incredible uprising that every legislator would have their phone ringing off the hook 24 hours a day, and I don't think that is realistic. I don't think that would happen. I'm not worried about that personally.
Hide money so they think you're poor and you don't have to pay very much.
Well, Look, you're worrying about something that is sort of problematic. I mean, you have to do what you feel comfortable with. My opinion is that if you invest in 529 plans, the state is not going to usurp that money. It's just as simple as that. So good luck.
Okay.
And thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks for the call. A lot of questions about college investments.
I guess so. Today is the college day.
That's great. Well, let's find out what the next caller has on their mind. And line number 4 in Monticello is next. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple questions about ordinary and qualified dividends when you're filing your taxes. On the 1099, all but one of mine are listed in both boxes as ordinary and qualified, so I assume all of them are qualified except that one.
That's what it sounds like. Is this from a mutual fund?
No, these are regular stocks.
All right, so that you had regular stocks. And did you hold those regular stocks all through 2003?
Yes, I did.
All right. So if you had dividends on regular stocks, U.S. companies that are traded in the U.S.?
Right.
All right. Then those should be qualified for the 15% rule.
Okay. Well, on Schedule B, when you go to fill that out, there's just a place for your ordinary dividends where you list your name of your payer. So we do not list those qualified dividends.
You know, I'm not a tax return preparer, and I haven't examined the 2003 Schedule B, so you're really asking the wrong person.
Okay.
So,
in the past, we've already put those on, but there's no place for qualified dividends. It just has for ordinary dividends now.
Well, you've stumped me.
Okay.
There's probably a very, very simple answer. Maybe a CPA could call in real quick and answer that.
Okay.
Or you could call the IRS tax hotline and take your chances. But the truth of the matter is they're now about 70% correct as opposed to in the old days when they were only about 50% correct.
Okay.
So you might try that as well. And I'll have to take a look at it on a form myself.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
My
so
pleasure.
Much for your call. Okay, a couple other callers waiting. We'll go next to someone in Aerosmith on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello?
Yes.
On the government bonds at E&H, whatever, I don't know which ones. My daughter, which is a senior in college, has got them from her grandfather from the day she was born, just off and on. And I was wondering if she would need to cash them in to take the tax run of them now before she goes into the working force.
Well, is she in college currently?
Yes.
Well, there are rules, as I mentioned, where if you cash them in and you use the proceeds for college expenses, oftentimes, depending upon tax brackets, you may not have to pay any tax. So this is something that you need to check out with your accountant to see if, based upon either her income, if she's filing separately, or if she is your dependent, whether you are eligible to take advantage of that situation. So it's just strictly a mathematical calculation that your accountant would need to make.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. About 5 minutes left, a couple callers. We'll try to get them both in. Next up, someone in Georgetown on line number 3. Good morning.
Good morning. I tuned in late, and I know you've been talking about the college 529 plans, and I have been considering starting one for 4 grandchildren, 2 in Florida and 2 in Texas. They're 10, 9, 7, and 3, and I don't know if my son should be taking one out and I should be taking a different one out or combine them together, and I hate to have you repeat, but whatever you could give me for information would be great.
Okay. That's a great thing to do is to start 529 plans for 4 grandchildren. I laud you dramatically for thinking about doing this. And since they are in different states, what I would recommend, you have a number of choices. As I said, I like the Iowa plan. I like the Nevada plan. I like the Missouri plan. And you can go to websites, look those up. Or alternatively, you might consider even going directly to Vanguard and going to their Vanguard website. Vanguard has an excellent 529 plan. They're affiliated, I believe, with the state of Nevada because 529 plans actually are plans sponsored by states, interestingly enough. And in those particular 529 plans, you can then access certain Vanguard funds, which are pretty much index-oriented funds. So I like that kind of investing. You don't start a separate fund by a 529 plan by your son, and then you have a separate 529 plan. No, you put all of the money in one 529 plan. Interestingly enough, under 529 plans, you as an individual can take up to $55,000 of money per grandchild and fund $55,000 right out of the box. And if you are married, your husband can do the same thing. So you individually could put $110,000 per child into a 529 plan. I'm not suggesting you do that. And the reason that you are eligible to do that is currently we can do $11,000 a year.
Correct.
Gift tax free. But under 529 plans, you can aggregate 5 years. So 5 times 11 is $55,000. Now, you couldn't add the next 5 years, but if you needed to put a substantial amount in, you can actually do that. So some people who are in a position to do that, will a husband and a wife or two spouses could actually put $110,000 in for the benefit of a child, a grandchild. It doesn't have to even be a relative for that matter. And then your son or your daughter could add also to that 529 plan. Now, interestingly enough, some plans have upper limits of contributions, typically in the $175,000 to $225,000 range. So you can actually, what a happy problem to run up against, that you've hit your limit. That would be a wonderful thing.
Another question is, do these have like limits you got to put in so much per month?
No, absolutely not. Not
okay.
That kind of program. That's a prepaid tuition program.
Okay.
That's a prepaid tuition program. We're talking about your self-directing money, having it accumulate so it can be used for any type of higher education expense.
Okay, but the normal 529, most of them you don't have to put in so much a month?
Right, unless you're getting the prepaid tuition type, which
okay.
obligates you to a monthly amount.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thanks so much for the call. And I'm sorry to say there's a caller that we won't have time to include in the conversation. All I can say is we do this once every month, always on the third Friday. And a lot of talk about university college tuition planning this month. And we'll take up that and other topics next month. Our guest has been David Sinnott, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. And thanks once again for joining us.
Jack, it's always fun. It's just amazing the breadth of questions.
Absolutely.